Now, one big city mayor who's wrestling with soaring pension costs and falling revenues is Antonio Villaraigosa of Los Angeles. I sat down with Mayor Villaraigosa at City Hall this past week.
Mayor Villaraigosa, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Guy.
Let me ask you about pensions, because I know that this year the city contributed or will contribute about $500 million to the municipal employees' pension fund. This is one of your biggest expenses. In cities across the country, paying into these pension funds is in some ways draining the budget. As you know, almost nobody in the private sector receives a pension anymore. Do you think it's time to rethink the system of pensions for future city employees in places like Los Angeles?
Well, there's been a whole debate around the idea of providing defined contributions instead of defined benefits. And while I've said that I don't believe we should go down that track, I do believe that we need to redefine the magnitude, the size of the benefit, because they're not sustainable.
At what point does the city run out of money to pay those pensions?
One of the things we're saying to our friends in labor is that at a minimum, we have to renegotiate for the future new employees. Under state law, we can't renegotiate current employees unless we provide them with a benefit in exchange for cutting their retirement. But there's no question that we're moving toward a time when the level of these benefits are unsustainable.
About a month ago, it was estimated that the city could face bankruptcy if it didn't cut up to $200 million in spending. Is bankruptcy now, or was it ever, a real possibility for the city?
Well, I've made it absolutely clear that word is neither in my vocabulary nor a possibility for Los Angeles. The fact is, we're going to have to make tough decisions. We balanced the budget last year. We balanced about $400 million of a $500 million deficit this year. Next year, we're looking at a $486 million deficit. Like cities all around the country, we're struggling to make ends meet. 80% of the cost of our government is payroll, pensions, benefits. So what I've asked our employees is to take the lead that I've shown over the last 2 years, where I've taken a 16% cut, and I've said if everybody took a 15% cut, we would be able to resolve $450 million of the $486 million deficit. If we all shared in the sacrifice, if there was support for some of the public-private partnerships around parking garages and meters, our convention center and the zoo, we could generate the kind of savings that we need to put ourselves back on a sound financial footing.
What do you think makes Los Angeles, this city, particularly complex to govern?
California cities are constrained by various propositions which limit your ability to raise revenues.
You can't raise taxes
without a two-thirds vote of the people. And so that revenue opportunities just are a lot more difficult to try to take advantage of.
With such a high unemployment rate here in the city that you face, this budget deficit that you still might face before July, and then this estimated $500 million deficit for next year, what leverage do you have as the mayor?
You hit the nail right on the head. The fact is, there aren't a lot of options here. We have contracts with our employees that we have to abide by. So unless they agree to sharing in the sacrifice in these tough times, I won't have a lot of options.
Except to
lay off thousands of people.
Do you think realistically the jobs that have been cut here in the city, even if the city recovers financially, will ever come back?
We're going to have to reduce the size of our government, identify priority and core services, police and fire, sanitation, street services, libraries and parks, and get out of some services that historically we've provided. There is no way for us to get back on a sound financial footing with the size of the workforce that we have today, which is why I've said we've already eliminated 1,000 positions last year, early retiring another 2,400, may lay off, unless our unions share in the sacrifice, may lay off up to another 4,000 employees.
That's Antonio Villaraigosa. He's the mayor of Los Angeles. Mayor, thank you so much.
Thank you.
T.S. Eliot once wrote that in a minute there is time for decisions and revisions, which a minute will reverse. So thankfully, we're talking about 3 minutes because we have a winner for round three of our 3 minute fiction contest. More than 3,000 original short stories poured in for this round, stories about trains and cafes in London and Maine, all inspired by a photograph we posted at our website, npr.org/3minutefiction. Well, today, our judge for this round, author and all things considered book critic Alan Chews, has made a decision. And Alan, as T.S. Eliot said, in a minute there is time for both decision and revision.
But I promise I'm not going to change my mind in the next minute.
Okay. Now, Alan, before we find out the winning story, who you picked, can you read a few lines from stories that almost won?
Yes. This is from Garvin Gaston, who lives in Houston, and he took on the photograph immediately. His story opens this way. To be honest with you, I don't like the picture. I'd never go to that coffee shop, and I'd never leave my paper on the table to let someone else clean it up. So he fought that photograph.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to do it.
And this is a story that I liked a lot from Peggy Hansen from Boulder Creek, California. Lately, I'm obsessed with surfaces, doorknobs, tabletops, faucet handles, telephones, light switches, all the daily objects touched a dozen, 100 times a day by unwashed hands, fingering everything and leaving a film of microbes.
What great, great writing. It's just absolutely brilliant stories. But unfortunately, we have to pick one, or you have to pick one, Alan, which is a tough job. And I gather we are now at the moment we have been waiting for. Who is our winner this round?
The winner is Rhonda Strickland of Raleigh, North Carolina, with her story called Please Read.
And Alan, I understand that coincidentally, it turns out that when our producer called Rhonda, she actually said that she once took a writing class with you more than 20 years ago. Do you remember anything about her?
I remember what she looked like. I can honestly say that I don't remember a line that she wrote, and that would be horrible if she hadn't written these wonderful lines in the story.
Well, let's find out if Rhonda Strickland is indeed the same Rhonda Strickland that you remember. Rhonda, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Hi.
Hi, congratulations.
Thank you.
Hi, Rhonda.
Hi, Alan. It's been a long time.
Many, many decades, yes.
Rhonda, what do you do out there in Raleigh?
Well, I'm an artist. I work in fused glass, and I'm also a writer.
Well, you must have learned something from our Judge Alan Chews, you know, all those years back. Because
I did.
All the stories we received were first read by students at the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and then they picked just a few, you know, dozen to pass along to Alan. Now, Alan, what made Rhonda's story stand out?
A couple of things. First of all, it's in a man's voice, so there, she's daring herself to do that. And second of all, it moved toward the coffee shop window rather than away from it. Easy enough to depart from it, but difficult to position a narrative to move toward the object of the photograph. And it suggests, or as my dear old friend Byrne Melamed used to say, it predicates a life. You can just feel the life boiling up out of these lines.
Rhonda, before we hear the story, this is about, roughly, it's about teenage train hoppers in Tucson, Arizona. How did you get from the photo we posted to the story you wrote?
Well, it was someone looking through a window into a place that had a table with newspaper open on it. I just think it's a beautiful picture, but it immediately made me feel like an outsider. And I just had no impulse to put myself inside the shop, like reading the paper or the person who left the paper. And also, I'm getting ready to go to Tucson.
Ah.
By train?
Oh, no, I wish, but no.
Not going to hop the train?
I'm not going to hop the train. the last time I was out there, I found that there's this whole train hopping community out there. And I was always intrigued by the few details that I learned when I was out there about this underground culture.
It's just amazing to hear how that photograph inspired all of these different stories and led to your story, Rhonda. And as you know, because you're the winner, you'll receive a signed copy of Alan's book, To Catch the Lightning. And of course, Alan, I'm going to pull out my stopwatch here because I want to time Rhonda's story. You're going to read it. It has to be under 3 minutes. So let's hear it. The story is called Please Read.
In Tucson, we found the train-hopping kids and went with them to New York City. I was 15 and had never been out of Arizona. That summer, I'd learned to eat from dumpsters, carry a knife in my pocket, and sleep with my backpack chained to my waist. My girlfriend Sarah was scared to try, but when she saw I'd go without her, she came. New Mexico and Texas floated past, framed in the open rail car door. We slept under a Baton Rouge bridge, partied in New Orleans, changed trains in Atlanta. Sarah was liking this now. At Penn Station, we stepped outside, and the cold stung our skin. We stood there and blinked. The other kids headed round back of a coffee shop to dumpster dive. Sarah called to me. I shook my head, and she went. I knew she'd bring back something, a stale donut, a still-warm half cup of coffee. In the shop window, I studied my reflection. Wild red hair stuck out from knots Sarah couldn't untangle with her broken comb. My eyes seemed too large and staring. My beard still looked strange. I thought of Phoenix. I'd left home over a month ago, telling no one. I hugged myself, shivering. We'd have to find coats, sweaters. I stopped seeing myself and looked through the glass at a warm table with a spread-open newspaper carelessly left behind. The pages fluttered each time a customer opened the door and went in. Sarah came up beside me, handed over a half-eaten apple. She said, "No coffee." Her hands were blue. She followed my gaze. "We'll get newspapers tonight." She meant for sleeping. Old papers were everywhere, littering the ground under bridges, inside doorways, beside creeks and riverbeds. We stuffed our clothes and covered ourselves when it rained. She said, "Come on, Ben." But I couldn't stop looking at the newspaper, how people walked past, ruffling the pages, not noticing. The paper danced in the draft they created and inched across the table, moving close to the edge. Sarah tugged my arm, and I looked anxiously at the Tucson kids rounding a corner, searching for food. I didn't know how to explain to Sarah. I wanted this paper. I wasn't thinking of Phoenix anymore, of my home and my parents. I wanted to fold this newspaper shut with a crease, protect it from the gray, sooty day, keep it from falling to the floor where it would soon get covered in black shoe prints. But I couldn't get myself to go in, take it from the table. In its perfect frame of polished wood and gleaming glass, lit by lamps and the glowing smiles of people sipping coffee from steaming china cups, I knew the paper wasn't mine.
What a wonderful story. And Alan, we timed that at 2 minutes, 38 seconds. That's Alan Chu's reading Please Read, which is a story by Rhonda Strickland. She's the winner of round 3 of our 3-minute fiction contest. And congratulations to you.
Thank you very much, Guy. And thank you, Alan. It's wonderful to hear it read.
It's a wonderful coincidence, but not such a coincidence. You wrote a wonderful story.
And Alan, thank you so much for your stewardship this round.
Great pleasure, Guy.
And this is just a reminder that round 4 of 3-Minute Fiction will begin next weekend. We'll have a new challenge and a new judge, author, and Patchett. Thanks to all the folks who helped with this round of 3-Minute Fiction, Rob Hill, who graciously provided his wonderful photograph, and our talented readers from the Iowa Writers' Workshop, Abby Palmer, Andy Graff, Annie Sloniker, April Seifer, Charity Stebbins, Chelsea Dappin, Chinello Okparanta, Emily Ruskovich, Erica Jo Brown, Gabrielle Zanoni, Jill Bodak, Jonathan Raley, Kayla Sawyer-Stein, Lori Martin, Lucy Silag, Michael Fover, Montro Rothholz, Ryan Lenz, Samuel McPhee, Scott Butterfield, and Ted Kehoe. And thanks to our producer, Petra Mayer, for this round. And to see the winning story and to read some of our readers' picks, visit our website, that's npr.org/3-minute fiction, and that's 3-Minute Fiction, all spelled out, no spaces.
Okay, so in this era of information overload, you're feeling stressed, forgetful, overwhelmed. That means your mind is perfectly normal. So says Douglas Merrill in his new book, Getting Organized in the Google Era. He's a former Google executive, and he writes that his own struggle with dyslexia forced him to develop techniques for remembering information. His early fascination with the brain led him to earn a PhD in cognitive science. We spoke to Douglas Merrill about what the brain can and cannot do.
Everyone has the same limitations. I have slightly more as a dyslexic, but generally speaking, we all have quite poor short-term memories. We're all quite bad at storing and encoding information for later, and we all get overwhelmed, and when we get overwhelmed, we forget things. But unfortunately, we don't know that we've forgotten them.
Well, talk to us about our ability to multitask. You're just saying that no one is really that good at multitasking?
Even more than that, no one can, in fact, multitask. Your brain has a short-term memory, which it uses to store the things that happen around it in the world. And then it takes in that short-term memory and encodes in the long-term memory so you can find it later. That short-term memory can hold between 5 and 9 things, and that's all. And if you're multitasking, you're more likely to forget the things that are in that short-term memory. Everyone feels like they're tremendous multitaskers. It's a little bit like Lake Wobegon. Everyone thinks they're better than average, but you're not. You can't multitask. When you shift from one context to another, you're going to drop some things. And what that means is that you're less effective at the first task and at the second task that you're trying to do at the same time. It's much more effective to spend time doing your first task, take a small break, and then do your second task. Managing the context shift is much more effective than pretending to multitask, even though we all think we're good at it.
There's another aspect of all of this that you write about in the book, and that is trying to shift gears.
If you think about it, changing from one task to another involves you changing context entirely from one slip to another. This is a phone call, that's an email. They may be related, but probably they're not. And so when you move from the phone call to that email, your brain has to stop what it's doing, move everything from short-term memory to long-term memory, and then reload your short-term memory with whatever you're doing next. That requires work. You don't perceive it as work, but you're using your brain muscles, if you will. And you're using them in a relatively inefficient way. It's much more efficient to take that phone call and then do the work associated with that phone call and then take a break and then deal with your email or whatever. So basically try to minimize the number of context shifts you can have. Tactically, for example, if you looked at my calendar, you would see that I try to clump all meetings related to a particular topic together. So I have, you know, 3 or 4 meetings related to a certain project. Rather than jumping back and forth between contexts, and therefore making it harder on myself than it needs to be. And another sort of facile but important tip is to put context data into your calendar or into your email trials. So instead of having to recall everything from long-term memory, you can simply look at your calendar and say, oh, right, this is an interview related to the book with the following elements. That at least allows you to, as you move into that new context, do so more efficiently.
Do you consider yourself at this point a very organized person?
No, I consider myself a disorganized person who's hanging on with it by tooth and nail to an organization system. It's why I built these systems, because I have to manage my own tendency to be very disorganized. If you walked into my office at home, you would see piles of paper all over my desk and often some on the floor. You'd see yellow stickies on the walls and big pieces of paper that I've taped to the walls. You'd see books in various piles all over the place. You'd walk in and you'd say, wow, this guy has no idea what's going on in his life. But it's not just looking organized, it's being organized that matters. So my piles of information actually have meaning, and once a week I go through and I reorder them and I throw things away and I add things, etc. I take time to repeat and understand what's in my piles. But no, if you walked into my office, you would not perceive me as the world's most organized person.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on.
Douglas Merrill, for several years, was the chief information officer at Google, and he now, along with James Martin, has written the book Getting Organized in the Google Era. Coffee growers have an extra reason to fear climate change. Coffee plants are notoriously sensitive to weather. And those who recently attended the World Coffee Conference in Guatemala are trying to figure out how to prepare for the possibility of a warming planet. Murray Carpenter covered the conference and began his report at a coffee farm nearby.
On a sunny afternoon, Estuardo Faya is using a wooden rake to turn the coffee beans drying in the sun on San Sebastian Farm. The farm sits beneath 2 volcanoes in Guatemala's Antigua Valley, and Faya says its award-winning coffee flavor is a factor of the rich volcanic soils and the climate,
El microclima que tenemos es especial.
The microclimate we have is special, Faya says. The temperatures rise more or less to 79 degrees and fall to 50 degrees at night. This is part of what gives it the quality. The world coffee market is not in imminent danger, but small changes in temperature and precipitation can have big impacts on coffee quality and quantity. So growers like Faya are starting to think of ways to adapt to a changing climate. One strategy is moving coffee production to cooler regions.
You can move up the mountainside as it gets warmer, but you actually run out of space because mountains have this unfortunate property of being pointed.
Peter Baker studies coffee for the nonprofit Cabby Bioscience. He says coffee plants are fussy, especially the fine Arabica coffees that Americans prefer, which are typically grown in tree-shaded farms in the mountains.
Often call coffee a Goldilocks plant. It likes it not too hot, not too cold. It likes it not too wet, not too dry. So the conditions are really quite limiting, and farmers have a real struggle. As we've seen in Colombia this last year or so, they've had the heaviest rainfall in recorded history, really.
Colombia's rains were associated with a strong La Niña weather pattern, which cannot be blamed directly on climate change. But Baker says the record rainfalls, which decreased Colombia's coffee harvest by a quarter last year, are consistent with the generally more chaotic weather that climate models predict. For its part, Colombia's National Center of Coffee Research has developed more than 200 weather stations to better advise farmers and document climate trends. And Brazil, the world's largest coffee producer, is also planning ahead for a changing climate.
The problem of coffee in Brazil is if we increase the temperature, we have a problem of the flowering. This is the first problem. The second problem is the water deficiency.
Eduardo Assad of the Brazilian Agricultural Research Corporation says warm temperatures can cause coffee to flower early, reducing productivity. He says Brazilian researchers are trying to develop coffee hybrids better adapted to warmer and drier conditions, but that could take years. Alternately, the coffee farms might have to move.
We have 2 million hectares of coffee in Brazil, and with the new scenarios of climate change, maybe this production can go to the south of Brazil.
Back under the volcanoes on San Sebastian Farm, Estuardo Faya is looking over some coffee plants that have flowered, but only on half of the branches.
La lluvia que nos cayó no fue lo suficientemente...
He says the rain that fell 2 weeks earlier was insufficient, and if the anticipated rains don't arrive soon, he will irrigate in order to stimulate more flowering. And it may cause connoisseurs to cringe over their coffee cups, but a warmer climate will encourage more coffee farmers to plant the hardier, caffeine-rich but bitter, Robusta varieties over the mild, tasty Arabica coffees. For NPR News, I'm Murray Carpenter.
All this week, NPR is looking at the serious problems facing many public pension funds. A recent report by the Pew Center on the States says 21 states have pension plans that are not properly funded. 8 states are in especially bad shape. In Pennsylvania, the state's 2 large public pension plans are viewed as relatively healthy, but even there, generous benefits and worse-than-expected investment returns have combined to raise doubts about the future. NPR's Tamara Keith reports.
These fourth graders at Hershey Intermediate Elementary School don't know it, but paying for their teachers' retirement benefits is going to cost them. Dr. Linda Brewer is the superintendent of the Derry Township School District in Hershey.
They're going to be paying for this down the road when they're grown and they have jobs.
Brewer may be projecting into the future, but what she's talking about is on a lot of people's minds. Pennsylvania, like many other states, hasn't done a very good job of setting aside money to make good on the pension promises it's made. Soon, school districts around the state will have to dramatically increase their pension contributions. For the Derry Township schools, the bill will jump from about $600,000 this year to $3.7 million in 2013.
It's very significant.
Brewer is looking at some stark choices: cut programs and increase class sizes, or raise property taxes.
Our retired citizens are saying, do not raise our taxes, and our parents are saying, we don't want you to raise our taxes, but if that's what it takes to maintain these solid programs, that's what we want you to do.
Pennsylvania's governor and others want to soften the impact of the looming crisis with an accounting maneuver. They want to spread the pain of making the pension funds whole over a longer time frame. But critics say they're just kicking the can down the road. This plan would avoid a property tax increase today, but will no doubt hit those fourth graders and their families eventually. But as Brewer sees it, these pensions are how school districts like hers attract highly qualified teachers. Jerry Alexiak became a public school teacher 25 years ago, partly for the pension benefits.
I knew I was not going to make the money that I could make elsewhere. I was willing to do that because, first of all, I love teaching. And secondly, I knew that there was something worthwhile at the end of that.
Combine the pension obligations for state employees and teachers, and Pennsylvania currently has more than $20 billion in unfunded liabilities. That amount is expected to balloon in the next few years to more than $55 billion. But the amazing thing is, just 10 years ago, these pension funds were running surpluses.
Some of the worst things are done in the best of times.
Stephen Nickel works for the State Teachers Union now, but in 2001, he was a member of the Pennsylvania House of Representatives. The pension funds were flush with cash, and those surpluses were burning a hole in the state's pocket.
There was like euphoria, and legislators in Pennsylvania and other states basically dipped into their surpluses and increased benefits for employees.
Nickel, a fiscally conservative Republican, was one of the very few lawmakers to vote against the expanded benefits. Before the ink was dry, it became clear the surpluses weren't going to last. But instead of putting more state money into the pension system, the legislature opted to defer the suffering for 10 years. Robert Gensel is policy director for the State Workers' Pension Fund. He says what the legislature did didn't make the state's unfunded pension liabilities go away. It only made them worse.
The Commonwealth has basically been saying to us, keep paying that money, pay this increased benefit. And we say to them, well, it's going to cost you a lot of money. And they say, well, just put it on our tab.
And he says the tab keeps getting bigger and bigger. The market crash in 2008 dashed hopes that stellar investment returns could solve the state's pension problems. Both of the state's big pension funds lost more than 25% in a single year. Rick Dreyfuss with the Free Market Commonwealth Foundation in Harrisburg says Pennsylvania's pension predicament, like that in so many other states, is the result of politics.
Pension plans are run for a political rate of return, and that is to say that it's easy for a politician or a policymaker to give benefits right now, even retroactively, and then defer that cost up to 30 years.
There's really no political upside to raising taxes or cutting programs to make pension funds whole. Like all public pension funds, in Pennsylvania, obligations to retirees are ironclad, and eventually state residents will have to pay. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. Today in Your Health, two dilemmas of aging, treating muscle cramps and testing for prostate cancer. Millions of middle-aged men get a blood test called PSA every year. They hope it'll find prostate cancer early, but many doctors think it causes men as much harm as good. NPR's Richard Knox sorts through the controversy.
Like most men of a certain age, I've had a bunch of talks with my doctor about PSA, prostate-specific antigen. I get the test every year. When the results come back, my doctor and I kind of scratch our heads trying to figure out whether the number means anything or not. So far, so good. So when I read that the guy who discovered PSA thinks that using it to screen for prostate cancer is a big mistake, I called him up, and he didn't mince words.
It cannot do what it's been purported to do. It can't detect prostate cancer, and it's resulted in a public health disaster.
He's Dr. Richard Ablin of the University of Arizona. To explain why he's so critical of PSA screening, he had to explain what prostate cancer is like. He says, think of the prostate gland as a box with no top.
We can think of an aggressive cancer as a rabbit that jumps out of the box and spreads. The non-aggressive cancer is a turtle which crawls around the box and goes nowhere.
The problem with a PSA test is that it can't tell if a cancer is a rabbit or a turtle, or even if there's cancer at all. It just shows whether one marker for the disease is remaining stable or going up. That didn't stop Brad Baher from asking his doctor for a PSA test. Baher's on the faculty of the Oregon Episcopal School in Portland. He and his doctor go way back.
My personal doctor is a high school friend. We've known each other for about, well, not quite 40 years.
It goes back to Mrs. Farrow's class freshman year in high school.
Craig Redfern was a budding doctor even back then.
I stole her cigarettes out of her purse one day to try to get her to stop smoking, but it didn't work.
When Brad Baher said he wanted a PSA test, Redfern told him the test could be worse than the disease, since most prostate cancers are turtles, not rabbits.
He considers it sort of a slow-growing, not very threatening kind of a cancer.
Baher got his PSA test anyway. He'd had a colleague with prostate cancer who told him to get tested. But Dr. Redfern cautioned him not to panic about whatever the result was. He didn't want his friend to start down a slippery slope toward unnecessary treatment for a slow-growing cancer, treatment that can cause impotence and lifelong incontinence. He told Baher about a 66-year-old patient who had a tiny spot of cancer in his prostate.
He probably did not need to have surgery.
But the man insisted on it anyway.
And despite all of that, is suffering quite a bit from urinary incontinence and needs to wear a pad. So I think he's one who's done poorly.
Brad Baher sees it another way. He's sympathetic with that man's decision.
You know, he's the one that had to go to bed every night knowing that he had cancer. And he had a hard time sleeping, I bet. Cancer's a really scary thing.
So over the years, Dr. Redfern gave Baher a couple of PSAs. The results remained stable. Then when Baher was 55, he had some urinary symptoms. His wife said, get it checked out. Another PSA test had a higher score. Then 2 months later, it jumped up again.
Since he was my friend and I didn't want any potential conflict of interest in decision-making, I suggested he just see the urologist and decide whether to proceed with the biopsy.
They went ahead. The biopsy found not just cancer, but pervasive cancer. Fortunately, though, Baher's cancer seemed limited to the prostate. He had it removed, and he's doing well 18 months after the surgery. And now he's glad he had that series of PSA tests.
Yeah, I think maybe the test did save my life.
I asked Dr. Redfern what he thinks might have happened with the cancer if his friend hadn't had all those PSA tests.
Probably in 2 or 3 years it may have become apparent in other ways, and at that point not likely to be curable.
Brad Baher represents the proper use of PSA testing. Don't do anything on a single test, but monitor the results over a period of time. The problem is not all doctors are doing it that way. There are still a whole lot of biopsies, surgeries, and radiation treatments being done on the basis of a single above-normal PSA test, at great cost to patients and the healthcare system. But Baher says the healthcare system is a system.
I'm not part of the healthcare system. I'm just me trying to stay healthy.
As for Redfern, he points to a European study last year that says for every Brad Baher whose life is saved, you end up doing treatments on 48 others who probably didn't need it. Many of those are left incontinent and impotent as a result. Even so, the study has Redfern leaning a little bit more toward recommending PSA tests to his patients.
But I usually also follow that up by noting that I've opted not to have my PSA tested.
Every man, he says, has to decide for himself. Richard Knox, NPR News.